From the Department of Surgery at the University of Wisconsin, welcome to The Surgery Set. I'm Jonathan Kohler, an assistant professor in pediatric surgery here in Madison. I'm new here, and with this podcast, I'm exploring the ideas, inventions, and innovations of our department, plus meeting a lot of really interesting people. I'm excited for you to join me. Our guest today on The Surgery Set is Dr. Michelle Chuchi, an associate professor in the Department of Communication Sciences and Disorders, with a joint appointment in our department, the Department of Surgery, in the Division of Otolaryngology, Head and Neck Surgery. Dr. Chuchi studies sensorimotor control for voice and swallowing disorders, and Parkinson's disease. She is the primary investigator on an R01 grant from the NIH that supports her work in uncovering how the early stages of Parkinson's disease affects communication. Dr. Chuchi, welcome to The Surgery Set.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
I've just sort of started learning a little bit about your work. Can you tell us a little bit, just first of all, you know, how you ended up here at the University of Wisconsin?
Sure. So my training is unique in that I have training in both speech and hearing science and speech language pathology and as a speech pathologist, and then also in neuroscience. And so I started out doing work in humans with Parkinson's disease and looking at the effects of neurosurgical intervention called deep brain stimulation surgery and how that affects communication and swallowing. And in that work, I discovered that there's a lot that we don't know about Parkinson's disease, about the disease progression, what aspects of the neural pathology actually contribute to communication and swallowing disorders in people. And I also realized that I wasn't really able to answer a lot of these questions with human clinical work. And so I began doing training in more translational basic science in animal models of Parkinson's disease. So during the second half of my postdoctoral fellowship, I started collaborating with Dr. Nadine Connor, who is also up here, who does oral motor function, swallowing disorders, and basic science models of aging.
Yeah.
And so I started collaborating with her and then wound up getting a faculty position here at the UW.
So did you start as a speech pathologist and then sort of progress through to a PhD now in very much basic science studies around Parkinson's? Or
sure. So the trajectory for speech pathology is you do an undergraduate degree and then do your master's degree, take board exams, and do a clinical fellowship. But when I was in graduate school, they started a master's to PhD program. And so I did go all the way straight through with my PhD and did my PhD work in human clinical work, but with a neuroscience distributed focus. And then it was during my postdoctoral fellowship where I really started getting into the more bench science and translational animal models. So we developed assays in rats and mice to look at vocalization, tongue function, chewing, and in these models of Parkinson's disease and aging.
Yeah, so talk a little bit more about that model that you're developing, because really what you're doing is you're trying to identify Parkinson's disease way earlier than when I sort of, with my rudimentary understanding of like the clinical presentation of Parkinson's, you know, I think of it as very evolved tremors, micrographia, you know, difficulty with ambulation, and you're looking way before that.
Sure, and I think it might be helpful to give a broader picture of what Parkinson's disease really is.
Yeah.
So historically, we thought that Parkinson's disease was the death of dopaminergic neurons that live in the midbrain and project to the basal ganglia. And when these dopaminergic neurons die, you do get these cardinal signs of Parkinson's disease. So slowness of movement, postural instability, and a tremor. Turns out when that happens, you're about midway through the disease. And there's a lot of other degeneration that happens in other areas of the brain. And now we think probably even in the peripheral nervous system and in the muscles that happens well before you get those cardinal signs. The thing is, by the time somebody actually goes to a neurologist, they already have this tremor and they're midway through the disease. And we haven't trained people to really pick up on some of the early subtle deficits that might happen. And I can describe some of those to you.
Yeah, can you tell us a little bit about sort of like what those early signs might be?
Sure. And so with the caveat that some of these are nonspecific, and it doesn't mean if you have one of these then you're for sure getting Parkinson's disease. But
I'm ready to believe at the end of this conversation that I have Parkinson's. I've been a second year medical student. I know how that goes.
Yes, exactly. So loss of sense of smell is one of the first signs of Parkinson's disease. You have gastrointestinal dysfunction, which might come in the form of dysmotility, sometimes either esophageal or lower GI dysmotility, constipation, sleep disorders. So REM behavioral disorder is another one. Quiet voice. So that's one that people don't oftentimes pick up on. They think their spouse needs a hearing aid. And yeah, so those are some of the things to look out for before you would actually have something like a tremor.
Yeah.
And those kinds of things that I described that happen a little bit earlier aren't related to the primary disease process that we typically attribute to Parkinson's disease. Thus, they're also not responsive to the medications that we give to people. And so one of the things that my lab is trying to do is to try to figure out what the exact nature of the pathology is that's causing early GI dysfunction, early communication dysfunction, early swallowing dysfunction, in the hopes that we can stop it, prevent it, slow it down, or develop drugs that could target those specific pathologies.
How much earlier do you think these symptoms appear relative to the larger Parkinson's tremor?
That's a great question. So the average age of onset for typical idiopathic Parkinson's disease, not young onset, but typical, is 65 years of age. And we think some of the more subtle deficits start to be noticed about 10 years before.
Wow.
And the disease probably starts about 20 years before.
Wow.
So we do have this huge window of early detection and neuroprotection that we can capitalize on.
Yeah.
That's the good news.
Do you have a sense, I mean, how much of this is sort of lab-based basic science, and how much of this are you able to sort of elucidate, like the sensitivity and specificity of loss of sense of smell in Parkinson's?
Sure. So there have been some controlled studies that do define loss of sense of smell as an early biomarker. But like I said, going back and historically looking at patients, we don't tend to collect those kind of data early on. So there are current efforts by some Parkinson's centers of excellence to start following people just generally as they age, people who might be at risk for Parkinson's disease because of some kind of exposure or genetic vulnerability, or people who are maybe showing some of the earlier things that I talked about, like a REM behavioral sleep disorder, and then trying to study movement and communication and swallowing. That's hard to do in humans. So the approach that I'm taking is looking at this in a rat model of Parkinson's disease. And I can talk a little bit about
please.
That.
Sort of how it's a great time to be a rat.
Right, right. So recently there have been several genes that are associated with getting Parkinson's disease that is almost identical to the sporadic form of Parkinson's disease. There's about 15 to 17 genes now. One of them causes an early onset familial Parkinson's disease. So in humans, if you have a homozygous mutation of this gene, people tend to get Parkinson's at about the age of 20.
Wow.
And it progresses pretty rapidly, but it looks like typical Parkinson's disease.
Mm-hmm.
So what we did is we knocked out those genes in a rat. And so now we have a rat that starts to develop Parkinson's disease at about 2 months of age, which is early adulthood.
Yeah.
Now at 8 months of age, that's when they start to show that death of the dopamine neurons and the cardinal signs of Parkinson's disease. But between the ages of 2 months and 8 months, we have the preclinical window where we can study the early signs, and then we can study the pathology that goes along with it. And so I believe that using these animal models allows us to study the onset, progression, and pathology of the disease in a controlled fashion, because we have animals that we know have Parkinson's disease.
Yeah, that seems like such a good way to think about the animal model, is identify the gene in the human and walk it back, rather than, I feel like so many animal studies sort of identify something in an animal that may or may not have a human correlate and try to take it the other direction.
Right.
That's really cool.
Yeah, and we spent a lot of the past several years really characterizing this animal model. So what kinds of early deficits do they have? Do they have vocalization deficits, fine motor skill deficits, chewing, respiratory deficits, tongue function deficits, and other general motor deficits? And then we're starting to find that there's pathology occurring in the gut, esophagus, peripheral nerves, and muscles of the pharynx and larynx, before we see pathology in the central nervous system in the brain, which is consistent with how we think Parkinson's may actually start and spread.
Does this work allow you to speculate at all onto what the real cause at a cellular level of Parkinson's disease is?
Yeah, so Parkinson's disease is complicated. There's death of populations of neurons, and there's presence of aggregated proteins called Lewy bodies. And one of the main proteins in that is called alpha-synuclein. Alpha-synuclein is present in practically every kind of cell that you have, but something causes alpha-synuclein to become misfolded and sticky, thus causing these Lewy bodies to form. And so you have the Lewy bodies and the death of the dopaminergic neurons that really are the hallmark pathologies that occur really throughout the body. How this actually happens, though, is a bit of a mystery still. And so every time somebody figures out a little piece of it, it opens up about 10 new avenues to pursue it. So there's oxidative stress, there's mitochondrial dysfunction, and you can exacerbate these things with environmental factors, with genetic risks. So the more we know, the more we don't know about it.
As usual, right?
As usual.
So it's a multi-hit model of some sort, you know, predisposition and then wrong place at the wrong time kind of thing.
Right. And then there are certain genetic forms. And then we're finding the genetic forms of Parkinson's disease. These genes are also involved in sporadic Parkinson's disease as well. So things are gelling together, which is hopeful.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I'm just fascinated by this idea of like measuring all these functions of a rat.
Right.
So what does your lab look like? I mean, you have like somebody there with smelling salts, seeing if the rat can smell, and another guy looking at the motion of the tongue, and how does it work?
Yeah, so that's a great question. It's really important when you are designing animal studies that whatever you're testing in the animal has a behavior that's analogous to what humans do. So let's take vocalization, for example. So with humans, we move air up through our larynx, we vibrate our vocal folds, and we move our mouths to create the speech sounds. And it's within the range of human hearing. Rats vocalize in the ultrasonic range. So we can't hear it. It's at about 50,000 hertz.
Wow.
Right. And so what they do is they just make a little whistle shape through their larynx and blow air through and then modulate it at the level of the larynx. So it's not exactly like human speech, but it has meaning. It changes the behavior of the recipient. They use it for playing and mating and locating each other. And so we elicit these vocalizations and then we record them. And then we analyze the acoustic properties, much like we would record human voice and speech and analyze the deficit in the acoustic properties.
And you just have like a control group and a...
Yep, we have a control group and a mutation group.
Yeah.
That's right. And then, so we have a bunch of different kinds of assays. So if we go from kind of a gross motor, we have them walk on a balance beam that's tapered. So it gets a little bit harder for them to walk at the end. There's a little ledge below and we can see how fast they walk across it and how many times their foot slips off.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so we can get a measure of gait. We can do fine motor control with, we give them a piece of uncooked pasta, and then they do this hand-over-hand motion to feed it into their mouths because they love it as a treat.
Huh.
So we can look at the fine motor control of their hands. We can then record their chewing as they're biting this pasta. And then Nadine Connor adapted this apparatus where we have basically a lever that's hooked up to a force transducer, and it can also deliver a little bit of water. So the rat comes into the apparatus and then licks this lever and gets water to drink. And then we can see how fast they can lick and with how much force.
Wow.
So humans don't necessarily use their tongue quite in that way, but it's analogous.
Right.
So we look at all different kinds of movement, all different kinds of oromotor function and vocalization. We also do a modified barium swallow study.
Huh.
So that's how we would diagnose and treat oropharyngeal and esophageal swallowing disorders in humans. We can do that in rats.
Wow.
So rats
swallow
some barium.
Contrast while they're getting irradiated, and you can like do a actual swallow study.
You can do a swallow study and make
that's
the
amazing
kinds of quantitative measures that you do in humans. So oropharyngeal, upper and lower GI. So
so interesting.
Yeah. So I think that, you know, you're careful to interpret your data, but for the most part, it's analogous to what we can see in humans. We can really get at what the deficits are. And importantly, we can look at interventions. So we can look at early exercise or environmental enrichment. We can look at specific drugs and see if we can preserve these behaviors, rehabilitate these behaviors. And then we can look at the mechanism of that as well.
Yeah.
So if we can exercise their tongues and make their licking and their eating better, how are we changing the muscles, the nerves, and the central nervous system? we can figure that out, then we can also backward design drugs to address these as well. And which is really the goal, is to prevent, slow down, reverse, cure.
Right. Incredible. So in 10 years, where do you see things going with the work that you're finding now? Is it that we're going to have primary care doctors are going to know to screen for chewing or smell or vocalization? Is it that, you know, we're going to have targets for early intervention? And where are we headed?
Yeah, that's a great question. So with the advent of big data sets, for example, we can look at things like swallowing function or voice samples and enter them into big data algorithms. And this is what we're working on the human side of things, to figure out, okay, are these swallowing patterns? Are these vocalization patterns looking more like normal aging or a person with Parkinson's disease? So we're hoping that, you know, with collecting that kind of data in the office, that you could then have a program or send it in somewhere where you would get some probabilities. Like, all right, there's a smell test that's already developed out of Pennsylvania. So there's already a smell test. Some people like Max Little are working on vocalization algorithms. We're working on a swallowing one. And so we're hoping that in the office, you could have somebody, you know, talking to your iPhone. You could get a swallow study, or hopefully we're going to have some more office-based, easier kinds of assessments to do.
Yeah.
Smell test, and then send in and look at probabilities. And then, you know, you can go, if somebody is looking like they might be more at risk, then having a more in-depth evaluation.
Right.
Follow them a little bit more closely. Ideally, my dream is, you know, all right, now let's do some non-invasive types of things to maybe prevent you from having a swallowing problem if we think you're at risk.
Early identification, early intervention.
Yeah. But, you know, nothing, you know, and exercise is really promising for Parkinson's disease. So, you know, nothing that would require the person to quit their job and only address Parkinson's disease, but just really finding some specific things that people could do, or a specific compound that somebody could take to slow that down.
Yeah.
Potentially.
That's so fascinating. Well, thanks so much for coming in to talk to us today. And I consider myself much more educated about Parkinson's disease. And I'm also going to go home and make sure my swallowing feels good. It does make you a little nervous, you know?
It does.
I'm like sort of, oh, REM sleep. I identify with problems in that.
Yeah, right. So. Yeah. So the take home point is, any one of these things in isolation doesn't necessarily mean anything. We're trying to really hone it down. But if you think you have a problem, it's always good to check it out.
Yeah. And just start with your primary care doctor. And
that's right.
Kind of go from there.
Yep. And if with any voice or swallowing concerns, speech pathology.
Perfect. Wonderful. Well, thanks so much for coming in, and thanks for being a part of the Surgery Set.
Thanks for having me.
All right.
We hope you enjoyed this episode. Next week, our guest will be Dr. David Rothenberger. He's the J. Phillips Professor and Chairman of the Department of Surgery at the University of Minnesota. Dr. Rothenberger's career as a colorectal surgeon and cancer researcher spans more than 3 decades. He'll speak with us about physician burnout and strategies to prevent and mitigate the phenomenon in our own careers. We hope you'll join us. The Surgery Set is a production of the Department of Surgery at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. This episode was produced by Rebecca Wazileski and myself. It was audio engineered by Chris Hansen and edited by Alex Worley. Our theme song is On Wisconsin, arranged and produced by Jamie Schmidt. I encourage you to visit us at surgery.wisc.edu, where you can find links to Grand Rounds, free CME credits, and more. You can also check out the UW School of Medicine and Public Health Video Library for a wide range of medical education resources at videos.med.wisc.edu. In addition, you can subscribe to this podcast on iTunes. And of course, you can follow us on social media. You can like our Facebook page and also find us on Twitter at Wisc Surgery, as well as me at J.E. Kohler. Please feel free to let us know how we're doing, and especially let us know if there are topics you'd like us to cover. Thanks, and we hope you check back soon. On Wisconsin.